6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication.
Good afternoon. It is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013. And I am Tim Hansel, and your host of A Public Affair this afternoon. Today, what we are going to talk about is the Second Amendment, and in particular, we're going to talk about the history of the Second Amendment. And our guest today, joining us for the hour, is Dr. Saul Cornell. Saul Cornell is the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair of American History at Fordham University. And he is the author of a 2006 book entitled A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and the Origins of Gun Control in America. Dr. Cornell, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's just talk a little bit about the origins of this book. So, you know, after Sandy Hook, the massacre at the school, there's been a lot of talk about gun control again, renewed debate over, you know, whether or not we should close gun show loopholes, whether or not we should sort of reenact a ban on, whether or not we should reenact a ban on assault weapons. And, of course, you know, whenever that sort of discussion comes up, people start throwing the Second Amendment around. They start saying things that the Second Amendment protects a certain kind of right. It protects a right to self-defense. It protects a right to, in some cases, insurrection. And, of course, others disagree, and they say that, no, there's not an individual right, but more of a sort of a collective right. But your book sort of takes a different approach, right? You mentioned these sort of two interpretations of the Second Amendment, but you also put forth this sort of third idea, what you call the civic understanding of the Second Amendment. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. If you go back to the text of the Second Amendment, it reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the first thing we need to think about is that the Second Amendment has two parts. The first part, the so-called preamble, states the absolute necessity of a well-regulated militia for a free state, and then the second part states that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, very few people understand where this language comes from and what the reality that Americans were dealing with, the fears and the hopes that were driving them to put a text like this in their constitution. So the first thing to keep in mind is that unlike most of the other rights in the Bill of Rights, the Second Amendment is, with the exception of maybe the jury, is the only right where government can tell you to do something. You can be forced to bear arms. The government couldn't force you to speak. It couldn't force you to pray. It couldn't force you to assemble. But in 18th century America, it could force you to bear arms. Now, what we also forget is that the very first state constitutions that affirm a right to bear arms, and actually most of them don't after the American Revolution, also include a right not to bear arms, and that's worth pausing to think about. We don't hear a lot about the right not to bear arms anymore, but it absolutely makes sense if you think about the fact that there are religious pacifists in that society, people like Quakers or Mennonites, who cannot bear arms. They're religiously scrupulous about bearing arms. So the first state constitutions, and indeed the first draft of the Second Amendment in Congress, actually includes not just a right to bear arms, but a right not to bear arms. And I think that puts the whole original understanding of the Second Amendment in a very different framework.
So it's my understanding that actually the original draft of the Second Amendment actually included something about the right not to bear arms. Is that true?
Yes, that's right. I mean, there originally was a clause that allowed people who were religiously scrupulous not to be forced to bear arms. And we have the debates about why that was taken out. And it's sort of interesting because the reason it's taken out is there's a fear that the new federal government will use that ability to suddenly start classifying everyone as Quakers and effectively destroy the state militias by sort of Quakerizing everyone. You know, it's a little bit irrational, but of course, as we see today, the one area in American politics where you can always count on some irrationality is debates around the Second Amendment. So, you know, that kind of irrational fear, like so many of the irrational fears we hear today, has a long and deep history when dealing with the right to bear arms. I mean, the other thing that's important to recognize is that this is a well-regulated militia. That well-regulated militia was an institution that was absolutely essential to the colonies and to the new republic. It's in a way, it's a combination citizens' army, Rotary Club, Boy Scout troop, and it's not just people spontaneously deciding, you know, I'm going to take up arms. This is a legal institution. The militia statutes that define who is in the militia, that say what kind of guns you have to have, that actually require you to report to muster or be fined, that allow the government to inspect privately owned weapons. All of these regulations are part of this idea that the militia is an institution drawn from the people, but it is a legal entity. It is not simply a bunch of people in John Deere caps with their AR-15s going off into the weekend in the woods and you know, thinking about overthrowing their government. In fact, in 1776, most of the states disarmed people who refused to swear a loyalty oath. So the idea that somehow the right to bear arms is part of some right to overthrow government turns out not historically to capture what happened. In fact, every time that it was usually farmers in the early republic, or occasionally with slaves as well, every time somebody tried to take up arms and form their own militia, the federal government sent in the well-regulated militia to crush the rebellion. So, and also it's important to recognize that there's only one crime that's defined in the Constitution, treason, which is taking up arms against the government. So although you hear among the sort of pundit class this idea the Second Amendment is some kind of constitutional right of revolution, that was the view of Daniel Shays, the person the Founding Fathers viewed as the antithesis of liberty, not the person who the Founders thought was the embodiment of liberty.
That's interesting. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Saul Cornell from Fordham University, and we are talking about the history of the Second Amendment. Dr. Cornell is the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and the Origins of Gun Control in America. Dr. Cornell, can I ask a question about this tension between the militia and the standing army? I'm trying to get my head around why we included this as an amendment in the first place. So there was this debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and the Anti-Federalists were worried about something and wanted to have that in as a protection. Is that an appropriate understanding?
Well, the important thing to keep in mind is the Founders were heirs to this English tradition which feared standing armies. We, of course, now have the most powerful standing army in the history of the world. The Founders, when they fought the American Revolution, quickly realized that we too needed a standing army, and so there was this tension in 18th century American thought between venerating the militia as the great institution that could protect liberty and realizing that if you were going to fight a European standing army, you needed a standing army of your own. But there's no question that if you look at the early state constitutions, they always pair a statement of the right to bear arms with a statement about the danger of a standing army. So the idea was you needed to have these citizen soldiers, again, who were not lone wolves or mobs. I mean, the Founders knew the difference between an armed mob and a well-regulated militia. But the idea was that if you transferred at least part of the cost of public defense to individual households, that would be good for Republican values and preserving Republican ideals and for protecting liberty. I mean, most people don't realize that in some sense the Second Amendment is part of this taxation program, which is transferring the cost of public defense to households. The first unfunded federal mandate and the first time the federal government made people buy something is not Obamacare. It was the Federal Militia Act, which required that you go out and buy a musket. I mean, the other problem that I think people don't tend to realize is that the great fear that drives much of the debate about guns today is this fear of black helicopters and confiscation. The fear that drove the Second Amendment was very different. The fear there was not that government would come and take people's weapons away. The great fear was that government would do nothing, and by inaction would contribute to the effective disarmament of the state militias. Because there were a lot of guns in 18th century America, but the kind of guns that most people wanted were not the kind of guns that were good for military service. People wanted guns that were useful for hunting turkeys or killing varmints on your farm. So they wanted, fowling pieces, sort of shotgun-like guns and birding guns. Mm. And most people recognize that if given the choice, American citizens would not go out and get assault weapons. They would get the guns that they needed to put food on the table. And so there was always the assumption that government would have to provide guns for the people. And there was a fear that this new federal government would just conveniently decide not to do it, and that would effectively disarm these state militias.
So I'd like to get to these sort of competing conceptions, what you call sort of the modern conceptions, the collective right model and the individual right model. But what you've articulated, am I right in saying that what you've articulated so far has been your sort of notion of the civic right model?
I like to say that if we actually honored the original Second Amendment, it's a nightmare for the NRA as much as it's a nightmare for gun control groups, because we would be a much more militarized society, unquestionably, but the level of regulation in order to effectuate that idea of a well-regulated militia would make Wayne LaPierre's head explode. I mean, George Washington wants to put everyone's name on a national militia roll and wants to inspect privately held guns twice a year. I mean, the very discussion of having even a national database or even allowing trace data of guns used in crimes to be entered in the database sends the sort of gun rights advocates into a frenzy. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the founders believed that, how are you going to get this militia to muster unless you knew who was in it, that they were properly trained, and that their weapons were properly stored in a good working order. So if we actually followed the modern gun rights ideology and applied it to the Second Amendment at the time that we got the Second Amendment, or even worse, during the American Revolution, we would all be taking tea with Piers Morgan at 4 o'clock. there would be no America. We'd still be a British colony. So it's kind of ironic that a lot of what drives our contemporary debate, even though it invokes the Second Amendment, it actually is antithetical to the original understanding of the Second Amendment.
So I think that's interesting that you use the phrase the original understanding. That as far as I know, we've had these fairly recent Supreme Court decisions. One in 2008, and the other in 2011, right? Washington D.C. versus Heller, and McDonald versus Chicago, and in both of those decisions, the what we might call sort of the right or conservative wing of the Supreme Court said that there is a right to personal self-defense, that this the preamble clause to the Second Amendment, this a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the state, is not an exclusive clause, that there are these other sorts of notions that are sort of fit with the Second Amendment. But Scalia, in his own words, says he's an originalist. He says that if and to quote him, he says, quote, it's what the words meant to the people who ratified the Bill of Rights or who ratified the Constitution, that he has this sort of originalist understanding of, how we're supposed to interpret the Constitution. Why does he now have say that this self-defense business is part of the original understanding?
Well, I mean, I think Scalia pays lip service to the idea of originalism, but what's interesting about Heller is that the criticisms of Heller by conservatives, by originalists in particular, has been scathing. In fact, Heller's been more Heller, in terms of its theory, not in terms of what it held, has been more severely criticized by conservatives than even by liberals, because the really honest conservatives think that Scalia is just playing fast and loose with the evidence, and some have described his methodology as incoherent. You follow the footnote trail, and he cites texts that were written 70 years after the Second Amendment and says that's how we should understand what it meant at the time. Unless you believe in time travel, it's sort of preposterous to be using 19th century text to understand an 18th century constitution if you're an originalist. The problem Scalia had is that under a living constitution theory, it's very easy to justify an individual rights theory of the Second Amendment, because most Americans absolutely believe it's an individual right. The problem is Scalia has built his whole career around this theory of originalism, and so he had to he had to gin up evidence and manipulate evidence to get it to fit his theory. If he had had a different theory, he could have come to the outcome in a very straightforward and logical way, instead of building this sort of Byzantine structure to hide that he was manipulating the evidence left, right, and center. The other point to make is that, you know, what's really hard for most Americans in contemporary America to understand is there's no question the founders believed in an individual right of self-defense. That right was well established under English common law. In fact, it was so well established, it doesn't make any sense to believe that they thought they needed to constitutionalize it, because it really was not threatened during the era of the American Revolution or during the period after the American Revolution. What was under threat was the militia, and that's why they constitutionalized the right to bear arms in a well-regulated militia. So, you know, the right that's important to most Americans, which I think is self-defense, although obviously hunting is also important to a lot of Americans, the right of self-defense under English common law was just not controversial in the 18th century, and indeed it was much more narrowly understood than it is in modern America, because the right under English common law requires you to retreat to the wall before you can respond with deadly force. It's very different than these right, you know, stand your ground or right to shoot laws that have sprung up all over the country. So again, if we went back to the founders' understanding, we would actually have to repeal all these stand your ground laws.
I'd like to bring some callers in on this discussion.
Well, I'm sure that'll be very lively, won't it?
How about we go to a caller? Caller, could you tell us your first name and your question or comment?
Hello, I'm Ron.
Hi, Ron.
In 2013, which groups in the USA are well-regulated militia? Are the Coast Guard, the Air Force Reserve? Is the Wisconsin National Guard a well-regulated militia when it's under the governor's control? Would it be if it's under the command of the U.S. president? I mean, which groups actually qualify as being constitutional militia?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, this is a fascinating issue because, of course, what we have systematically done in the 200 years since the Second Amendment is to move as far away from their vision of the Minutemen ideal as the true embodied militia, and we moved much closer to what they would call select militia, which is a highly organized, highly trained set of military forces that can supplement the standing army. So, I mean, I think the simple answer, although it's not a simple question, is the legal embodiment of the militia today has become the units of the National Guard. We could return to the founders' much more expansive vision of the militia, but it would require an enormous assumption of responsibility and an enormous burden on the part of the citizenry, because we would all have to be prepared to muster at a moment's notice. We would all... the government would dictate what kind of weapon we could own. The government would inspect that weapon. We'd be subject to fines if we refused to turn out for muster. So we could live the founder's Second Amendment, but it's a huge burden on the citizenry. And even as early as the first decades of the 19th century, you had the people like Joseph Story, one of the great Supreme Court justices and constitutional commentators, basically bemoaning the fact that people were not willing to submit to militia discipline anymore, and that the founder's idea of the militia was already in decay even by the 1830s.
So basically what you're saying is that we would all, this would be a universal draft.
In a way, the militia effectively turns the entire citizenry into a potential pool for military service. You know, we'd be living in Tel Aviv or in Zurich. We wouldn't be living in modern America. And, again, we could choose to do that as a society. But, you know, given people's reactions to serving on jury duty, I can't really imagine that people want to go back to the founders' militia.
So where in your book, Well-Regulated Militia, you sort of trace how this sort of original understanding of the Second Amendment, this sort of civic-minded sort of responsibilities plus rights ideal, had sort of evolved into sort of the two sort of competing ideas that we have now, right? We have what you call sort of the individual rights model and the collective rights model. How did these two sort of, how were they sort of born out? How did they start to arise throughout our history?
Well, it is, of course, a complicated story that my book, A Well-Regulated Militia, tries to unpack. One of the key transformations occurs decades after the Second Amendment. Second Amendment really is about a problem that 18th century Americans have dealing with the militia. And what happens in the 19th century is for the first time you have cheap and reliable concealable weapons, including handguns and some really scary knives like the Bowie knife. Mm. And once these kinds of guns, which are not military weapons, are readily available and are reliable, because handguns in the 18th century are not very reliable. So once that happens, then you start to see what is true to this day. Guns don't kill people, but guns do increase the effectiveness and lethality of violent encounters. And you start to see some real social concern about rising levels of interpersonal violence facilitated by concealable weapons, really handguns, and in some cases these Bowie knives. So then you start to see the first modern-style gun control or weapons control laws. And it's at that moment where you start to see the two gun control position and gun rights position emerge in modern thought. They have nothing to do with the Second Amendment, which is really an 18th century debate about the militia. The modern debate between gun control and gun rights is really a 19th century Jacksonian market revolution era development. And in a way, we've been fighting over that since the Jacksonian era.
So you do mention that a lot of this sort of arose as sort of a backlash to regulation, that states were enacting fairly strict regulations on the ownership.
Yes, they were banning handguns, in particular in the South. So the question becomes, what do we learn from this? Because the one thing that seems clear is there's a bizarre codependency between radical gun rights and radical gun control. Like, the two positions feed off one another, which, you know, if you look at the way this debate sometimes plays itself out in our popular culture today, it's easy to see how those two extreme views are pretty codependent on one another. So I think the lesson is, this is a country, and I think it's true to say that we're actually not in a gun control paradigm anymore, that a sort of European English model of gun control where you radically restrict private access to firearms is not really a viable strategy in America, given our cultural and legal traditions, and given that we have 300 million guns in America today. What is absolutely necessary is a coherent and effective regulatory regime, and I think what my book very clearly shows is that as long as there have been guns, there have been regulations. The key is to find regulations that will effectively reduce levels of interpersonal violence, but not be perceived by people who own guns to be a threat to their ability to defend themselves. And that is the kind of mature public policy debate that, for the first time in my professional career, I see us having in some places, although it is not obviously the debate that gets the most attention when you put on sort of a radical gun rights person on CNN with Piers Morgan. You don't get that kind of debate. But I do think, at least in my own state of Connecticut, there has been a much more calmer, more reasonable, really thoughtful debate that has started. And I'm cautiously optimistic we will be able to pass some laws that will not offend sensible gun owners, but will give us a more effective regulatory regime to get guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them.
Well, let's try to have some of that mature discussion here. We have some callers waiting. I should stop and say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Tim Hansel, and I'm speaking with Dr. Saul Cornell, author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and the Origins of Gun Control in America. And we are talking about the history of the Second Amendment. So let's go to some callers. Caller, what is your name and your question?
Hi, my name is Larry, and I'm calling about a fascinating article that I read last week by Tom Hartman entitled, "The Second Amendment Was Ratified to Preserve Slavery." He quotes a number of interesting writings by some of the founding fathers, Patrick Henry, George Mason, James Madison, at the time that the Second Amendment was being drafted and debated, and there was explicit concern for the possible effects of the new Constitution on the slave patrols in the South. This is an institution I wasn't terribly familiar with, but apparently all white males were required to contribute time each month to search the slave quarters on plantations looking for illegal weapons, and to patrol the county and administer 20 lashes to any slaves found off plantation without permission. There was a great concern that the way the original Constitution was written would have left loopholes in their mind that would have allowed the feds to outlaw these slave patrols, disarm them, and thereby cause great harm and disruption to the social order in the South. I'd be curious to hear your guests' reactions to that theory.
Okay.
Well, of course, everyone from The Daily Show to CNBC has been calling me about that one, as you can well imagine. And like so many things, that takes some solid research and sort of spins it in a way that's more sensational and more simplistic than the original research upon which it's based would have you believe. So here's how I would describe it. There's no question that one of the main concerns of the anti-federalists who are against the Constitution is that the new federal government will take control of the militia and will somehow undermine the ability of the states to use these militias in ways that they have traditionally used them. Now, in the North, one of the ways the militia gets used is, of course, there's no police force, right? So it's to enforce public order and to put down rebellions and riots and things of that sort. In the South, that very same function, of course, focuses less on farmers upset about taxation, which is what happens in the North, particularly after the Constitution is adopted, and a little bit before in Shays' Rebellion, but is much more concerned about the threat of slave rebellion. So Southerners, like, for instance, in the Virginia Ratification Convention, clearly talk about the danger to their militia, and one of the many things they are worried about is that they will no longer be able to effectively put down slave rebellions. So there is a kernel of truth in that, but I think it's somewhat distorted to say that that's what the Second Amendment is about. That is simply one aspect of the more general concern that these Southerners have, that and the anti-federals in general have, that the new federal government will make it impossible for them to use their militias in ways they perceive to be absolutely essential to protect their citizens.
So you'd say it's part of the reasoning, but not the only reason. Is that the...
Yes, it's part of the reasoning, and it would be a mistake to say the Second Amendment is about protecting slavery, but it would be perfectly true to say that the fears leading anti-federals to demand the Second Amendment, at least in the South, are driven in part by a fear about slavery.
Okay. Well, let's go to another caller then. Caller, what's your first name and your question?
My name's Ken.
Hey, Ken.
And I'm calling. One thing that hasn't been really pointed out, which I feel is fanning the flames of the situation, just one facet, is the United States government's war on drugs, especially the marijuana trade, that if marijuana was made legal, then it wouldn't be as high priced. It wouldn't be a $3,000 or $4,000 a pound product. And I know plenty of people who are basically pacifist, laid-back, rainbow, you know, hippie-type people, but they got guns to protect their crop. And if there wasn't this pressing from the government coming to seize your marijuana, as well as for other people trying to steal what's so inflated in price. So I think that if, for example, if marijuana was legalized, the price would come down, the black market would be taken out of it, and there'd be less use for guns, and that one respect would reduce the violence.
Well, I think the caller's absolutely correct. We have a number of people who have made the argument that the current situation we have with treating drugs as a crime instead of treating drugs as an addiction issue leads to criminalization and leads to black marketeering and increases the value of drugs and leads to an incentive to arm yourself to protect your investment. We know for sure that the crack cocaine epidemic had an enormous impact on violence in urban areas when that was a problem. So, you know, I wouldn't disagree that if we want to really deal with gun violence in this country, we need, it's not just about gun laws. It's about a whole range of ways in which we deal with mental illness, we deal with drugs, we deal with everything. And if our goal is to make our society safer, and if we were behaving in a calm, rational way, we would be having spirited and thoughtful debates on all of these issues, including why why we are treating drugs as a criminal problem instead of as an addiction issue, which I think would be a much better model. And rather than trying to incarcerate people, I think we should help people deal with their addiction issues.
Well, that's, you know, part of the question is you know, how do we reduce, you know, the violence and the epidemic that we have in this country? I mean, just yesterday we had another shooting at Lone Star College in Texas. But then we have Wayne LaPierre who comes and gives a speech and says, well, you know, we should do these things, but we have to keep in mind that there's this right out there, right? There's the Second Amendment right. And he goes so far as to say it's absolute.
So you sort of wonder, you know, I used to think Wayne LaPierre was just an evil Machiavellian genius. And now I'm sort of inclined to think Wayne LaPierre's not that smart. Or he just doesn't understand the most basic principles of government and constitutional law that, like, a 10th grader ought to master. Because there's no right in our tradition that's absolute. You know, the First Amendment freedoms are certainly not absolute. The idea that you would be required to have a permit in order to demonstrate is pretty well established. And, you know, it's been a while since I've been in Madison, but, you know, I can easily imagine the reports of Madison if you wanted to sort of spontaneously parade to show your support or opposition to some law, that you could cause a great deal of public havoc, if not, danger, by suddenly, without any warning, taking to the streets. That doesn't mean that you're not, allowed to assemble and to protest and to speak your mind, but we all accept that some kind of reasonable regulation of that is in all of our interests. We also certainly don't think that, for instance, freedom of religion includes the right, you know, to practice human sacrifice or a variety of other types of things that are not protected by the First Amendment. You know, we all agree that there's no real First Amendment claim to be able to make child pornography. So the fact that Wayne LaPierre would say that any right is absolute, you know, either he's being extremely dishonest or he's not that smart when it comes to matters of law. You know, I used to think he's just devious. Now I'm beginning to think if he just doesn't understand the U.S. Constitution at all.
Well, let's see what some of our callers think. Let's go to the phones here. Caller, what's your name and your question?
I actually have a couple questions, and I have a point. One is I wasn't aware that George Washington advocated registering and checking on people's private arms versus the musket issue.
Uh-huh.
And also, who, when you talked about restricting handguns in the South, was that for a certain class of people, or was that for everybody? So those are my two questions. And my point is,
well, the Washington quote has to deal with his proposal for how to really make the militia effective. And so the notion is that your militia weapon will be subject to private inspection, and we will keep track of you for having it, so that if we need to muster militia, we can. And then, of course, also interesting is if you look through the laws that are passed to deal with firearms, of which there's actually a fairly long history, the only weapon that is exempt from, like, a seizure in a debt proceeding or that can't be taxed away from you is your militia weapon. So the law has always sort of recognized that weapons you own from the militia are subject to a slightly different regulatory treatment, and that most other weapons are subject to the same kind of property regulations that apply to any piece of privately owned property. And then, as far as the gun laws in the South go, they are in fact pretty broad gun control laws. Some courts strike them down. Some courts uphold them. What sort of emerges? It's interesting. In the South, you get at least among some courts a more permissive idea that there has to be a right to carry a firearm, either concealed or open. Outside of the South, however, a very different notion emerges, and the idea is that there's simply no right to travel armed unless there's an immediate threat to your life, in which case there's a kind of exemption for dealing with an imminent threat. But it has to be kind of an imminent threat. It can't just be, you know, I'm afraid of, like, some random stuff happening. It has to be, like, I have real reason to believe that I'm in immediate danger, and then you have a right to arm yourself on the public highways. Generally speaking, the right to defend yourself with deadly force it tends to, at least in the early period, although it does get broader as time goes on, tends to be defined by the home. You know, it's a man's home is his castle, and that's where that right to use deadly force governs, at least in the 18th century. So, I mean, it's a very interesting history. The idea that you know, we've basically always been living in this kind of Wild West fantasy, which turns out not even to be true of the Wild West, because you had to check your firearms in Dodge City and in Wichita, Kansas, when you came to the edge of the city. There actually has been some fairly robust gun regulation throughout American history, and although sometimes things get struck down, by and large, the courts generally, as long as the regulations are reasonable and aren't targeted against some insular minority, at least after the Civil War. Obviously, targeting blacks before the Civil War is completely consistent with the law of slavery. By and large, gun laws are generally upheld by courts, who tend to defer to legislatures, you know, who can enact laws that will best serve the public interest.
Now, was that true even with Heller? Did the court, the majority, leave open the possibility for continued
Well, that's
regulation?
The amazing thing about Heller. You know, I mean, if you were to ask me, I would say, you know, Heller is a poorly reasoned decision, and as a historian, I find Heller really deeply problematic. As a matter of law and public policy, I don't think Heller is all that much of a problem, because the laws that it struck down were badly written. They were the most draconian laws in the United States. They were never very popular public policy options for the vast majority of Americans. And there have been something like 600 lawsuits challenging gun laws since Heller, and something like close to 99% of them have actually upheld the law. So Scalia is very clear in Heller and said that basically the right defined by the Second Amendment does not guarantee a right to have whatever weapon, whenever you want it, and to carry it in whatsoever manner you choose to do it. The right is clearly subject to a broad range of regulations. You know, the District of Columbia's law was clearly over the line, because it essentially was a ban. But you know, anything that's reasonable and is tied to a clear public safety rationale, I think is likely to pass constitutional muster with the courts.
Okay. Colin,
can I interject?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to make the main thing was trying to make a point here. Okay. I know there's a lot of people on the line.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you talk about making a dishonest discussion, with all due respect, it seems to me that this is what's happening here, because, for instance, when you talked about the registration issue, the current-day registration issue, you brought in George Washington wanting to register arms. Now we find out that actually it was the militia arms. It wasn't the individual arms. If you look at the
these are arms privately owned by citizens, right?
I mean, the militia statutes
require you to go and outfit yourself with a firelock, and so... Washington is saying that privately owned weapon that you have to meet your militia obligation, I want to be able to look at it and make sure
you let me finish my point.
Okay. Is it Ken?
Hello?
Caller, your name is Ken?
Yes. Amos. I'd like to finish my point.
Okay, go ahead and finish your point. Go ahead and finish your point.
Okay. The point is that if you look at something like the Mexican-American War, the army that they got together, which at that point, by the way, the standing army was about 9,000 people. The arms that the Americans were using were not the muskets that the Mexicans had. They were using their personal arms in many cases, because they were more effective than the muskets that were part of the militia. So the arms that they privately held and that were not part of the registration were indeed military weapons that they were holding. You say that the issue is now rationally turning to that anybody who's concerned about a government which is going to have 30,000 drones by 2014 has trashed the First, the Fourth, and Fifth Amendment beyond anything the Founding Fathers could have ever conceived. You have an executive branch that says he has the right to murder and imprison people with no due process at all. And the Second Amendment clearly does not refer to defense against people coming into your house or hunting.
Hold on, guys.
Amos,
there's absolutely no evidence from the 18th century or even from the early 19th century of people, at least people on the winning side. There's a lot of interesting evidence of, like, you know, anti-federalists or Shays or the Whiskey Rebels or Fry's Rebels. There's a lot of people who take up arms against the government who think that they have some kind of right to take up arms against the government, and that that's somehow tied to a kind of right to bear arms. The government in place always sends in the well-regulated militia to put those down. So, you know, if, you know, one can certainly argue in terms of political theory that there ought to be some right, Lockean right of revolution, although most people would say that that Lockean right only exists once there's no functioning constitutional government. But the idea that the Second Amendment has anything to do with a spontaneous right of revolution is just has no foundation unless you're willing to say that, you know, Jefferson Davis, not Lincoln's vision of the Constitution, is the one we should live by. Because, I mean, Lincoln very clearly says, you know, what ballots have settled, bullets may not unsettle. And, you know, I share your concern about the executive presidency. I can share your concern about drones. But the idea that the Second Amendment would, you know, allow people unilaterally to exercise a Second Amendment option, the Founding Fathers clearly saw that as mob rule and anarchy. So, you know, we might want to make an argument in favor of that, you know, based on Mao or Che Guevara or Marx, or, you know, you could go to the fascists on the right, but you're not going to get it out of the Founding Fathers because those guys were Whigs. They were not, you know, Maoists. And I just find it, you know, intellectually problematic to try and make an 18th century text speak as if it was written, you know, by the weatherman on the left or by the, you know, KKK on the right. I mean, it's just not a text that can really carry that kind of freight. And, you know, the other problem with that is, you know, the way to deal with the abuse of power by our political branches is to stay politically active and to make the political process work. You know, the idea that somehow just stockpiling weapons is a good way to exercise political dissent, I think it tends to fetishize weapons. The way you know, weapons are tools. They're not political things. It's sort of funny that, you know, gun rights people think guns don't kill people, but somehow guns guarantee freedom. You know, it's an unbalanced way of viewing guns. I mean, you know, if they don't think guns kill people, how do they think that guns equals freedom? Mm-hmm. Seems to me political action equals freedom, and the use of guns can equal, you know, either protection or violence, but the guns are just tools, and we should recognize that they're very, very effective tools, and they change the dynamic when you're in a situation where there's violence, because they're incredibly effective at what they do.
Well, I'd like to get a few more callers here before we have about 10 minutes left here in the hour. I do want to just sort of stop and say that this is a public affair. I'm your host, Tim Hansel, and we are talking about the history of the Second Amendment and other Second Amendment issues with Dr. Saul Cornell, who is the author of 2006, A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and the Origins of Gun Control in America. If you want to join us in these last minutes and call us up, the phone number is 608-256-2001 or toll-free 866-899-WORT. That's 866-899-9678. And this is WORT Radio, 89.9 FM. So let's go to some callers. Caller, what is your first name and question?
Thank you. My name is Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Hi, Jim.
Yeah. Could you make a distinction for me? When does a weapon become military? When I was in the service, we were taught that the .45 caliber was a military weapon. It had much more shock value. So when does a weapon become military rather than just an ordinary individual weapon? Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, you know, that's a complicated issue that in a way is a legal question. I suppose technologically you could sort of argue about the genealogies of various weapons design, you know, whether they emerge out of a military model or out of a civilian model. I think that basically the debate we're having today about so-called assault weapons, or you know, I forget what the National Sports Shooting Federation calls them, modern sports weapons or something. I forget, they have a name so that they don't get called assault weapons. I mean, clearly, a lot of these weapons are modifications of standard issue military weapons, and the question we have to ask as a society is, okay, so what is the best way to regulate them? You know, it just strikes me as astonishing that anyone could think that just allowing anyone to buy one of these, and in particular buy one out of background check, and then allow them to store it in their closet, unlocked up, like happened in New Mexico, is just insane. I mean, you know, they don't let you store, you know, on a military base, you don't store weapons unlocked up. One of the most interesting things is what the Israelis have been doing, because they used to let soldiers take their military weapons home with them, and they've been moving much more to leave the weapon on the base. And what they've seen is, by requiring safe storage laws for military weapons, they've seen a huge decrease in suicides within the army with firearms. So again, the question is, you know, if we're going to be a society with a lot of weapons, which we clearly are, what sort of regulatory regime makes sense that will produce the greatest public policy reduction of violence, and, you know, give legitimate use of guns by gun owners the broadest possible protection consistent with public safety? That's like a rational debate that one can have. Of course, that tends not to be the debate that we have, because it always spins out of control. But I would like us to have a much more sound and calm public policy debate about these things. And like I said, in my own state of Connecticut, I see some signs we may be moving in that direction. I would love it if the rest of the country would have a discussion like that.
All right. Well, let's try to continue the discussion here. Let's go to another caller. Caller, what's your name and question or comment?
Hi. I would like to look at this from a linguistic point of view. The whole Second Amendment, which was ratified with the rest of the Bill of Rights in 1791, is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Webster's Dictionary, a modern one, says a militia is any army composed of citizens rather than professional soldiers called up in time of emergency. I think the Second Amendment should be repealed because I believe it's obsolete. And for this reason, the Second Amendment is a conditional sentence with a guarantee of the consequent clause, which is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, given as a result of the first or dependent clause, which is, in somewhat archaic language, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And if you restated the first part, the condition on which the amendment rests, you could restate it as because a well-regulated citizen army is necessary to the security of a free state. Well, we have an army. We have a standing army. Sometimes it is voluntary, or we have a draft now, but it's very ingrained in our government. So the condition is no longer there, and I believe that the founding fathers were rational men. By and large, I think they'd be loose constructionists today, and they would recognize that times change, weapons change. This was only designed to provide an army for a very tiny population, you know, that had recently declared its independence and gotten together as a unit. So I really believe the Second Amendment is nothing but a troublemaker, and it should be repealed.
All right, thank you, Gal.
Well, I tend to think that even if one wanted to do that, it would be so unimaginable that it would happen. It's not really worth. I mean, it makes for a good op-ed, but I don't know that it's really a practical solution. I don't think the Second Amendment poses any barrier to any sensible gun regulation that I've heard anyone in the mainstream of American politics talk about. There's I mean, unless you believe, like the caller believes, that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to give private citizens the ability to accumulate arsenals to take on the federal government, which, again, I think has no foundation in the amendment's text or history or early interpretation, except by some fairly radical groups that always end up on the wrong side of history, unless you believe in an insurrectionary theory of the Second Amendment, there's almost nothing on our contemporary agenda that would be prohibited by the Second Amendment that could pass through any sort of legislative process in America today. So I don't think it's realistic to use England as a model, because they have very different culture, they have very different history, they have a different legal tradition. I just want us to have a sensible discussion about what we can do to reduce the flow of firearms into illegal markets, to encourage safe gun ownership, and to get everyone to do what smart gun owners already do, which is lock up firearms. And I actually think it's a bad idea to allow people to develop their own private arsenals. I don't think that's consistent with the kind of polity that America is designed to be. I think self-defense has legitimate history in America. Hunting has legitimate history. Using the Second Amendment to take up arms against the government had a history, but that history pretty much ended with the Civil War, where we took that option off the table. And I think we live under Lincoln's Constitution, and there's no way to reconcile that insurrectionary theory of the Second Amendment with Lincoln's Constitution.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the hour here, Dr. Cornell, and there's one last thing that I'd like you to sort of talk about. We've spent most of the hour talking about sort of the what we might call sort of the individual rights sort of model, but you do talk about sort of the collective rights model sort of on the other hand, and say that's sort of mistaken as well. And could you just spend a couple minutes telling us a little bit about
the collective rights model? Was a model that slowly emerged at the end of the 19th century and became kind of an orthodoxy among courts and legal scholars in the beginning of the 20th century, and that basically said that the Second Amendment was a right of the states to keep their well-regulated militias. It's not a very good understanding of what the Second Amendment does, because, first of all, it doesn't deal with the fact that the right actually is something that citizens and eventually, I think, individuals after the 14th Amendment can claim. It focuses on the states as the holders of the right, which I think is not what the founders intended. They had this more complicated view by which individuals would be organized by the states, but not the states be the rights holder. So it gained a following among courts and among legal scholars until there was this very concerted effort to undo it, which ultimately resulted in Heller. And, you know, it's a brilliant example of how a vast interlocking network of right-wing think tanks, by sponsoring scholarship and flooding academic law reviews, you know, which of course are not peer reviewed. They're edited by students, and there are actually over 1,500 law reviews in America today. I think there's like at least 3 or 4 law reviews for every law professor in America. So there's almost no filtering mechanism. You know, you can pretty much get almost anything published in some kind of law review. So, you know, they basically created this alternative narrative around an individual right, and they were able to sell the courts on it. The problem was the old collective rights theory just was too hard to explain to any normal American, so that basically the gun rights people had a nice bumper sticker like explanation of what the Second Amendment meant to them. And for years, people who were pro-gun control had to talk about a collective right that you needed a PhD in political theory to understand, and that is not good in terms of politics. So I don't bemoan the fact that this collective rights theory is now an artifact of history, because it was just not a very good rendering of what it originally meant, and never really inspired anyone. You couldn't get worked up.
Dr. Cornell, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're sort of out of time, and I need to let you go.
Okay.
Thank you very much
for having me.
Our guest was Dr. Saul Cornell. This is a public affair, and I'm Tim Hansel.